Yes, it does. Live from the NASDAQ market site, this is Fast Money. I am Brian Sullivan, in for Melissa Lee, and your traders on the desk tonight are Tim Seymour, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. We're also pleased to be joined by Lori Calvasina, head of U.S. Equity Strategy at RBC Capital Markets. Lori, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We apologize in advance. Tonight on Fast, we're going where the money is, the big banks. You just heard Wilf talking about it. J.P. Morgan, Citi, Wells Fargo, all reporting their results before tomorrow's open. We'll break down what to expect. Big week. And we go west, young viewer, to the J.P. Morgan Chase Healthcare Conference in San Francisco. Meg Jarrell has the first on-air interview with the CEO of Agios. That stock down more than 6% today. We'll find out why. And pay attention.
Okay. Can you name
Can you name today's mystery chart? The stock dropping at 1.15%, bounced back a bit, had a bitter cold holiday season.
Interesting.
Any ideas?
It means something. That means something.
You probably do. It's a retailer. All right, we'll give you the name coming up. But we begin with news on trade. The United States officially dropping the currency manipulator designation for China. Let's get right now to Eamon Javers in Washington with more on this developing story. Eamon.
Yeah, Brian, that's right. Treasury now making it official at this hour. They are dropping that currency manipulator designation that they slapped on the Chinese last year. They're removing it today. The Treasury Department saying in a statement that's for two reasons. One is the appreciation of the currency that's happened since last fall. And the second one is agreements that they've made inside that so-called phase one trade deal. They're saying here in this agreement, China has made enforceable commitments to refrain from competitive devaluation and not target its exchange rate for competitive purposes. China has also agreed to publish relevant information related to exchange rates and external balances. So the Treasury Department here is saying that those are specific details agreed to in that phase one deal, which will be officially signed here in Washington on Wednesday. We still don't have a lot of specifics on what's in there, but this is some new information about what might be included, according to the Treasury Department. The Chinese delegation, Brian, arrived here in Washington today. We got some pictures of them at the airport getting into their cars. We are told that they will be here at the White House for an 11:30 a.m. ceremony in the East Room on Wednesday. I just talked to Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, just a couple of seconds ago here on the White House driveway. He said that there will be a social component to this as well on Tuesday night. They expect to have a dinner with the Chinese counterparts on Tuesday. So a lot of diplomatic rigmarole surrounding this signing, but we do expect ultimately to see the fine print of what's actually in the deal. According to Larry Kudlow, we'll see all of that text on Wednesday for the public to mull over and figure out what's in and what's not in this deal. Brian?
Oh, look forward to it. Eamon Javers at the White House. Eamon, thank you very much.
You bet.
All right, Guy Adami, the Chinese renminbi had already been on the upswing prior to this deal. It's above 7-1 U.S. dollar. Is this material for the equity market? For the currency market?
Was today. I mean, I think, in my opinion, clearly, I think most of the rally today was predicated on that news that was sort of announced earlier today. Great job by Eamon. With that said, and please, as the kids say, don't at me, but the president and the administration were correct that Chinese were manipulating their currency, except they got it backwards. I mean, for the last 2 years or so, they were trying to strengthen it, not allow it to weaken. That's number one. The biggest currency manipulators maybe in the world historically, or at least the last couple of years, have been us, given what the Federal Reserve has done. I just wanted to get that out of the way. That being said, yeah,
you
I think
did.
It helped.
You're
going to
get some ats.
So I've said it
you're
before.
Gonna get,
I'll say
you're
it again.
You're going to get your ats handed
I mean,
to you.
You know what? But I'll tell you this. Sometimes the truth is a painful thing, and that is absolutely the truth. However, market liked it today, and this melt-up continues.
Well, I agree with you. I think, if anything, China's had a capital flight issue. China's been very focused on currency stability because I think they want to be a major global center. The most important impact here of all of this is emerging market assets. If you buy the EEM, 40% of that is all based upon the Chinese economy directly, and then indirectly, China's influence as a currency on Southeast Asia and the entire region is a lot more important than it is here. Notice the outperformance of EM assets today. Notice the a lot of these assets that continue to move. But what it ultimately means is we can find a deal when we're looking for a deal. Go back to why we started all of this. I'm not sure we've solved any of this. I think Peter Navarro has been very much the leader of the China hawk territory, must have found something in a future negotiation path that seems like a compromise. Because even during good times and whatever we're calling now, and I think now are good times, but Peter has found a way to dig in on important issues he believes are part of this. And I don't think we got anything here.
Don't we want them, Tim, to be a currency manipulator? Because I think to Guy's point, if it totally free floated, most people that we talk to, I talk to, believe it would fall farther.
Right.
It would weaken, 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 which would then make their exports to the United States less expensive, negate some of the impacts of the trade war that we used to have or may still have again.
Right.
We want them to,
well,
to keep it stronger.
We want stability. And I think, as Guy pointed out, every nation is going to do what's in their sovereign best interest. But I think part of that is what's best for trade and also stability. And I think currency stability in China, if you think about the social issues that they confront on a daily basis and do, I think, a reasonable job balancing. And I know it's easy to be critical, but we don't have the same issues in this country. So the currency is going to be something that I think they have to control. And I think they will.
It just seems like a pretty odd concession, considering that there's actually no news about this deal. When we're really thinking about it, like what we know about it, it really is increased ag purchases by the Chinese, which they stopped buying once we put the tariffs up a year and a half ago. So to me, there's no there. There's no deal. There's no nothing. And the president said it last week that, you know, we may wait until after the election to really get into the meat of phase two. So there's no deal. All it is kind of like an easing of tensions. And then you have to start to ask yourself, why are we negotiating against ourselves? Why are we giving this big concession 2 days before we're supposed to have a signing ceremony for nothing? So to me, I think that investors are going to be sorely disappointed when we actually get the piece of text or the piece of paper, you know, on Wednesday. So.
No, I agree. And I think it's so odd that markets are celebrating something and we really have no idea what's actually in it, except that, you know, this vague notion that it's not going to be all that substantial and all that important. And, oh, by the way, we're about to start negotiating phase two, where all the hard stuff is really going to be. So I worry the market's going to be disappointed once the drama
they're
comes
giving,
back.
Maybe, Lori, they're giving something up ahead of that phase two.
No,
they're trying to ratchet down.
But I
the
thought
tension.
That we had all the leverage. That's what I just don't understand.
That could be a different point. I'm just saying, maybe they're trying to give a gift, a preemptive gift.
Maybe. And, you know, I think that's a fair point. We had a nice little move today. But at the end of the day, I think you have to ask yourself, is this a lull in the action, or have we really made, you know, substantial progress and we're not going to take a few steps back? And I do think the market is going to have ample opportunities, especially given where valuations are, where positioning is, to get a little indigestion later on.
All right. Now let's turn to what could be a major moment of truth for this record rally. Earnings season kicking off tomorrow morning with Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo reporting results. On Wednesday, you're going to hear from Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and on Thursday, Morgan Stanley. Will the big banks add more fuel to the market's fire? Or, Guy Adami, could we be in for a rude awakening on a sector that some might argue is priced to perfection, 2x book value?
Well, depending on the metrics you look at, I happen to think they're priced to perfection. Look at Citi, for example, which is now trading close to, I don't know, 1.7x tangible book, right around book value. Talk about J.P. Morgan now trading north of 2x book. You know, these are lofty valuations in an environment where, quite frankly, I don't think they deserve it. Now, people will say they're cheap on a P.E., that's fine. But in terms of price to book, you're getting to levels that we last saw 2008, 2009. And quite frankly, they didn't deserve it then. And I'm hard pressed to believe they deserve it now.
Well, if you look at things that are going to be related to net interest margins or loan to deposit ratios, which are as low as we've seen, I'm just looking at some data here since 1985, according to Fed surveys, there's a lot of things that could be headwinds. But here are the tailwinds. The tailwinds are the fact that the banks now are being run to be, I think, more aggressive in terms of their profitability, not just their balance sheets. And I think this is something that people are missing, except for the fact that the market is pricing this in terms of the re-rating. I don't think it's significant to go out and buy any stock for a dividend, but I think in the case of the banks, the fact that they're giving money back to investors, and I think that is everything to do with the breakout you're seeing in this chart. And I know Carter, anyone who's come on here has talked about this breakout of the banks. This has been a 10-year basing period, ultimately, and a re-rating period that I don't think just stops because you broke through or near resistance. You've broken through that. So I like the charts, but I think the fundamentals are fine.
Lori, the price-to-book ratio, and I'll look at J.P. Morgan just by itself, the rest are about the same, remain between 0.8 and 1 for about 8 years.
Yeah.
Now we're at 1.6 for JP. It's doubled in 3.5 to 4 years' time. Does it merit that kind of valuation?
Well, I think that's a bigger question about the market generally. Does the market generally deserve these lofty multiples? Probably no. And that's why I think you do have to go back to the relative valuation call. Where are things not quite as bad as they are in the market generally? And, I mean, just to pick up on the point about shareholder return, I'll tell you one thing I really like about the financials right now. It's one of the sectors where we're still seeing buyback announcements ramp up. They're getting more optimistic about returning cash to shareholders through the buybacks as well as the dividends. dividends. We're seeing those buyback announcements start to slow in many other sectors. So to me, I think you've got a long, you know, sort of a stable base here for a while.
Yeah, I would just add this, that the bank trade in the last few months is really about the Fed. It's about the Fed fixing the yield curve. Bank stocks did not like it this summer when we had the yield curve inverted. So we had those three consecutive rate cuts, and then we saw the expansion of the balance sheet. And if you look at what bank stocks have done versus the S&P 500 since early October, they've almost doubled the major money centers, the performance of the S&P 500. So it really comes down to, again, where do you think the Fed is? What are they going to be doing for the balance of 2020? And I would suspect, at least as far as the guidance that we get out of these banks, that it's going to be somewhat cautious given where the stocks have come, focus on the stuff that they can control, which is the return of the capital, that sort of thing. And, you know, as far as capital markets and all that other stuff, it may be more volatile. That may be good for them. We just won't know that for a couple quarters.
Well, I also think if you want some insulation, I think your point's well taken, Dan, in terms of the Fed and the impact and them kind of papering over a lot of issues, literally. But if you look at the regional banks, they don't really have that same kind of repo exposure. And therefore, if you are concerned, I actually think the regional banks should be more defensive here in this environment. The one thing you have to worry about, especially in the regionals, is they were very interest rate sensitive. And I don't think rates are going to get away from us here. But I do think there are reasons, and we see this in asset allocation right now. Excuse me. That has to do with we see inflation, we see reflation, and we see that in yields. That won't be great. That will be a driver for regional banks, but that won't be great for some concerns around credit.
All right. Good discussion on the financials. It's going to be a very busy week for those big banks and a very busy week for one Mr. Wilfred Frost. Well, amid the oncoming slew of big bank earnings, a chart master says there is one name that has maybe looked a little too good for too long. Carter Worth is at the Plasma to tell us what it is.
So I wanted to focus on J.P. Morgan, the darling. We prefer things like Goldman Sachs, frankly, Morgan Stanley, catch-up trades. But let's look at J.P. Morgan and maybe make the case why it is overdone at this point. You can see the chart, no judgments, annotations by me. Now let's focus on the breakout. And it's a textbook breakout, right? You can draw your lines this way, an ascending wedge. But the point is well-defined tops at a common level and a breakout. Now, once a stock breaks out, whether it's a semi or a bank or a retailer, how far can it go? It can go forever. But there is an old technique called a measured move. You take the width of the range. This traded in a range for 2 years before ultimately breaking out. And if you look closely here, the width of this range, $88 is the Christmas low, 114, 114, 114. It's a $26 range. Take a look at the next slide. $26. A measured move is the width of the range from the point of the breakout. We touched exactly $1.140 on Jan 2nd, and we stopped dead cold. My hunch is that this is overdone, and you want to play laggards rather than a stock like this that has already sort of met its objective. And as you guys were speaking earlier, it is reaching a price to book that makes one say, Here is, of course, J.P. Morgan versus the BKX since 2009, a 10-year chart. It's a double. And then just banks in general, and this is kind of the issue. What do we know? If I draw a line here in January and I draw a line here, the BKX has made no progress. I mean, banks as an aggregate, as a theme, as a bet, and they peaked right after the presidential election. It's where alpha goes to die. Maybe this gets better, but after the last 2 years, no results, unchanged absolute in a big bull phase, a disaster on a relative basis compared to other choices one could have made.
All right, Carter, why don't you come on over here, guys, and let's talk more about this here. I mean, he's not, as you said, Lori's looking at the chart. He's not making a value judgment initially, but he looks at the charts and says, this is what I think. What do you think?
Well, again, I go back to, you know, is this potentially signaling something about the broader market as a whole? And I do happen to think we're a bit overdue for a pullback at this moment in time. Now, you know, I am also sensing that investors really do want to find the relative value calls right now. Investors we talk to think stocks are overvalued, and they're trying to find things that haven't run up quite as much.
That.
Yes, yes. I mean, we did a survey.
So are they selling, or are they just, it's overvalued, but I'm going to still own them?
Well, we did a survey on this in December, right before the holidays, and we actually found that most of our clients were bullish, but they still thought stocks were overvalued. One of the things we found is they're very, kind of bullish on valuations. There's a lot of liquidity sloshing around the system. People think the Fed might be goosing things a bit. But just to get back on the financials, we are sensing that people are saying, okay, things have gotten a little overheated. Mm. Where have things not gotten quite overheated and wanting to play the rally?
Dr. Worth, I mean, let's put your psychiatrist, behavioral economics, out. You heard what she said. I mean, people, I believe it's overvalued, but I'm not going to sell it.
Right, but I don't want to quit, right? And that's it's ever thus.
I mean, I can't quit.
I can't quit, right? Or my cost base doesn't allow me to quit. I don't want to pay taxes. That's the nature. And we also know the clustering in big names, Apple and Microsoft. So much does depend on the financials, and the valuations in many names are reasonable. The case for J.P. Morgan seems like that's been the crowded one. That's the Apple. That's the Microsoft financials. I'd rather do something like American Express. Looks like a breakout coming, whereas J.P. Morgan already broke out, or a MetLife. There are all sorts of good names within financials.
Yeah, and I would just say I'm not going to defend, you know, sort of the leaders so far. I generally like the idea of laggards at this point. I think that's where investor appetite is.
So speaking of laggards, Tim just mentioned the regional banks. If you look at the KRE, the index that tracks them, it had that breakout. It's been range-bound. I think it late August it touched 48 bucks. It traded almost 60. Now it's come back and it's trading like 57.5. It is sloppy, and you didn't get the breakout. What does that mean to you?
Well, first of all, that's a sort of different kettle of fish. There are very good regionals and super regionals, but as an aggregate, the KRE has been a very unhappy proposition, and I just wouldn't do it.
You know, I want to read something from Morgan Stanley and have somebody comment. This came out today from their wealth management division, and I got it, and I read it, and I thought, this is really sort of a bluntly honest assessment of the markets, maybe, if you believe it. Here's what Morgan Stanley said today. Comparisons with the 1999 stock market are compelling. Complacency indicators are high. Valuations on nearly every risk metric for the index are above their averages. Compressed risk premiums leave little room for investment. Consider rebalancing your portfolio quarterly instead of annually. Trim passive exposure and selling extreme outperformers. So even Morgan Stanley.
Are you sure those aren't Dan Nathan's notes?
Yeah.
I mean, from
thanks, Dan. This is Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. This is what Morgan Stanley Wealth Management is sending out to all their RIAs and all their clients. And they're basically saying the markets are wildly or close to wildly overvalued.
Well,
this is not like some guy in his basement with a blog.
No,
no offense to that guy. I like him.
Mm. I mean, look, that's what makes a market. They're always buyers and sellers. But we all know that sometimes you get into a period where it's just almost frozen in autopilot up. And that's what this feels like. Complacency.
Is that what the charts look like to you, Dan?
No, I mean, the sentiment is dumb. The price action is dumb. All the points that they just littered in that like paragraph, they all make sense. But right now, nobody's taking them seriously. And this feels so much like January 2018. I can't tell you. And I know there's a lot of people are going to give you a lot of reasons why it's not. But it also feels like a lot of other times in my career over the last 20 years where indiscriminate buying, especially the concentration and the names that we're seeing, it won't end well. And it's going to end sooner than later. I'm not telling you we're going to crash and this and that, whatever. It's just not going to end well. No one can even see a 3 to 4% pullback. That means you're going to get 2x that, or maybe worse. And it's going to take like January or 2018. It took 10 months to make a new high once we topped out. Those are the conditions that are ripe right now.
You look at Gene Munster of Loop Ventures, frequent guest of this show. He wrote in his blog today, not in his basement, but he wrote in his blog today that Tesla is probably all short covering, and it's likely going to have a very sharp pullback at some point, or at least history says that kind of stuff. How risky are things right now?
They are. And the point you're citing, and point in time, that January of 2018, we're on the two-year anniversary of that. The transports are still below that level. The BKX is below that level. The materials are below that level. The energy. I mean, it's all dependent on this Apple, Microsoft, if you name. If there's any trouble in paradise and these darlings ever have a setback, market cannot sustain it.
Okay. I think that's an important conversation.
Trouble in paradise.
People are writing in. They're adding us. Is this the bear version of fast money?
Adding us.
They're adding up. I think this is just the realistic version.
No, but valuations matter.
Right? I mean, it's the realistic version.
Valuations matter, and it always comes back to valuation. I think we've made
and
that.
And everything is earnings growth. And by the way, earnings growth is expected to fall. Coming up, why Lululemon investors are no doubt feeling very cool today. Plus, all the biggest biotech bosses in the world are in one California hotel right now. They can check in. But will they check out? With the group lagging the overall market, could a big conference turn it all around? Be sure to check out the CNBC app for your smartphone, tablet, or TV. You can always watch us live there as well. We're live at the NASDAQ, and we're back after this. All right, welcome back to Fast Money. Lululemon looking like the apple of investors' eyes, hitting new all-time highs again today. The company raising earnings and revenue guidance thanks to a strong holiday season. Lulu is up more than 85% in the past year. Guy Adami, is this still a good bet for our viewers? Hard-earned coin, or are the dogs barking on Lulu?
I mean, you know,
we
have to address this. So I had to bring my dog with me right now. He's in the bed. Now Jason's playing all the dog bark.
Who let the dogs out?
We're bringing the dog outside, number one. That was flip. Number two, I mean, this is a stock, I think, across the desk, we've been positive on for quite some time. We pointed out the valuation is stretched, yet they have the EPS growth and the comp growth that sort of signifies they're going to continue to move the upside. And then you saw what they said today. So I think this is a name, despite the ridiculous move and despite my feelings about the broader market, you can continue to own. And I think we've been pretty steadfast in that.
I do think, though, dropping this into the conversation we had last block, would Lulu be doing this in an environment that's anything close to this? It would not be. It would not be. It is a great growth story. The addressable market in terms of the male addressable market, which is now, you know, 23%, it's going to grow significantly. That's where they're getting their growth from. That's exciting. The valuation's not exciting.
Okay. Well, it's not all sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows for retail. Five Below shares falling at one point more than 10% today. They ended down 11%. The discount retailer issuing a warning for the fourth quarter, saying sales fell short of expectations and blamed in part the shorter holiday calendar. Five shares now trading at their lowest level since January of last year. Any hope that Five Below will heat up from here? And I will remind our viewers that all retailers operate, Guy Dami, on the same calendar. They know this calendar years ahead of time, and everybody operates in the same retail framework.
Yeah, and this is a stock that's been on fire until then, but it's somewhat disingenuous to use that. And you're talking, it's not like they slightly missed comps. I mean, they were expecting comps to be up 2.6%, and comps were down 2.6%. That is a significant miss. So, look, I think at a certain point this will become interesting again on valuation, but I don't think this is necessarily a one-day event. And if you broaden it out, you see how the market takes names like this out to the woodshed when they miss, and this is what happens. And this is just one instance. But, again, it can happen across the board.
It's interesting, too, is the retailers like Lululemon that sell $100 stretch pants, Dan,
yeah,
seem to be outperforming companies that sell $5 iPhone cases.
I think it's also people who own Apple shares and Microsoft shares, and they have chunky positions, and they're up 100% year over year, and you go out and you buy yourself some see-through Lulus or something like that. I don't know, and I would throw Nike in there. You know, listen, on the flip side, near the five, you know, you have Dollar Tree, you had Kohl's. There were some really disappointing kind of sales in that quarter for a lot of those lower-end retailers.
Brian, you like music, right? Wouldn't Five Below be a great name for a boy band?
It would
Let's
be.
Go to commercial, though.
I like it. The hottest boy band in the world right now is BTS. Yeah. My initials. So every time I see that, I think, yeah, I'm hot.
You could have been somebody.
For a full round, I could have been somebody.
Tender.
Oh, well, we're at a boxing match in the commercial break. All right, for all a roundup of today's big retail movers, you can head to our website, CNBC.com. In the meantime, here's what else we've got coming up on Fast.
The biggest healthcare conference in the world has descended on San Francisco. We'll talk to the CEO of cancer treatment company, Agios, to get the latest on its pipeline. And later, Netflix racking up the nods for this year's Oscars. But will that translate into wins for investors? We've got that and a lot more when Fast Money returns.
And welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Agios Pharmaceuticals falling more than 6% today. They're now down 17% in a year, despite a big December ruling from the FDA giving Agios a big breakthrough therapy designation on its Tibsovo treatment, and an analyst community that is overwhelmingly positive on the stock. Meg Terrell's at the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference in San Francisco with the CEO of Agios. Meg.
Brian, thank you so much. And Jackie Faust, thank you for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having Agios on the program.
So Brian was just talking about the stock being down today, kind of going with the overall trend of biotech being down overall, basically on what people are saying is just not as newsy a start to this conference as many people hoped for. He also talked about an analyst community that loves Agios, and we saw that in the notes coming out today saying this is overblown. What do you make of the investor reaction today?
I think maybe there wasn't a whole lot new in what we were saying. I also think that I've gotten very philosophical about short-term stock price movements. We're in the business of bringing beneficial therapies to patients, and that's what we're going to continue to focus on. We talked a little bit about some of the milestones that we have coming up in 2020 that we're very excited about. And we went a step further and put some stakes in the ground around where we think the company could be in 2025. And many of the more financial type metrics around of some of that guidance was probably largely expected by analysts and investors. We've been getting very positive reactions in our meetings today. As you said, the analyst notes have been positive. So I think investors have a lot to digest today. So hopefully they'll digest our news in a very positive way over time.
Well, part of that forecast for 2025 is doubling the number of drugs that you have on the market. Tell us about some of those opportunities that you're looking at.
So today we have two drugs for the treatment of acute myeloid leukemia. We brought those drugs out of our internal discovery science in record time and got them to patients. They've done very well with patients and how they're treating those diseases. So we're looking forward to having four drugs by 2025 and across potentially four times more diseases than we're in today. So in at least eight diseases. And these drugs are going to take us into a new era for Agios, which is consistent with our experience in hematology, but we'll be going beyond malignant hematology and into serious blood disorders that are non-malignant diseases like sickle cell disease, thalassemia, and some others. So we're very excited about that. And it speaks to the expertise of our scientists, because these are all internally discovered molecules, and we're very proud about that.
So one of the programs that you have is for a very rare disease called PK deficiency. And one thing that analysts are focused on is just identifying more patients with that disease. And that's part of the business model when you're focused on rare diseases and rare cancers. So how is the progress with trying to identify everybody who has this?
So, and I think this is one of the things that speaks to Agios' creativity, because we're not afraid to tackle these difficult diseases. And we think there are no approved treatments for pyruvate kinase deficiency today. So we're very proud of where we are with the program. We have two phase three trials that are going to read out by the end of this year, and then we'll move to file for approvals of that therapy for these patients. We've learned a lot about the disease and received a very positive reception from the physicians who treat this disease, as well as patients. They are very happy that somebody cares about the disease and is working hard to develop therapeutic options for it. And what we actually found in one of these two phase three trials when we were enrolling, we found more patients than we expected to find in the disease. So we think our patient finding efforts have gone very well, and we're looking forward to bringing those therapeutic options to patients. We're excited about it.
So you are in a sweet spot for what big biotech and big pharma is looking for in terms of adding to their own pipelines. How do you look at the future of Agios as an independent company when companies are looking to do M&A in cancer and rare diseases?
Well, I can't speak for how they're thinking about us, but we continue to do what we do. We want to bring great treatment options to patients and really leverage the expertise that we've built over the years in cellular metabolism and a deep understanding of metabolic pathways. So we're just going to continue to work hard to do that and move things as fast as we can on behalf of patients and hopefully come up with some terrific therapies for them. So.
Well, Jackie Foust, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much.
All right, Brian, I'm going to send it back to you. And everybody, don't forget to tune in tomorrow to more coverage from the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference, where we've got another great lineup. Back over to you.
I'm sure you do. Meg Terrell, this is like back-to-back. Look at that lineup that Meg has tomorrow. She does like 40 interviews a day, and they're all great. Meg, we'll look forward to it tomorrow. All right. Biotech, though, trading lower today as the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference kicks off. You know, the IBB is up 9% in a year, but 41 different biotech stocks have done better than that, including 22, which are up more than 25%. Guy Don, what's your take on the space in general? If you just bought the IBB, you gave yourself a big chance of really underperforming if you just threw a dart.
Which I can understand people wanting to do, because then you lose the sort of the binary events. But I think you want to be in the space for exactly that, the binary events. And I think, listen, I've done a lot wrong here. I think we've done a lot right in terms of some of these biotech names. Look at Biogen, for example, that huge move off the bottom. Sarepta is a good example. Agios, which we just talked to, I mean, this is a very interesting company. You're talking about a $3 billion market cap company that currently has about $550 million on their balance sheet. Yes, it's sequentially down from last year, but you know what? They're healthy. They've done a couple raises. Obviously, that dilutes the shareholders. But again, you're playing for an event here, and you've already endured a lot of the pain. So I think this name, Meg just spoke to the CEO, I think AGIO is a name you can own right here.
Okay, good stuff. Well, as we said, there's a lot more from that healthcare conference coming up on Mad Money. Jim is speaking with the CEOs of CVS, GlaxoSmithKline, and others. That is coming up, of course, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Coming up here on Fast Money, the one airplane stock that is moving in the options market and does not have a Boeing 737 MAX problem. But first, we're on pins and needles. Dan steps up to the plate to pitch his big idea. Will this social media stock be a home run? Investors got Dan's fast pitch coming up. All right, welcome back. It is time now for an instant replay. No, we're not checking tape from the Astros 2017 World Series win, which now I think, guys, would have an Astro Ricks on it.
You didn't
we,
say
you know what? We should just keep moving, Brian.
Okay.
I think we've already had a couple. I've contributed some bad humor tonight.
Very bad.
Yeah.
Dog's
no,
at least you didn't bring your dog in. All right, earlier this month, Dan Nathan stepped up to the plate to pitch Salesforce.
So when I think about what's going on in the market here, if we're going to continue to see a melt up and people are going to reach for high valuation, high growth things for beta, Salesforce is going to break out.
All right. Since then, shares of Salesforce are up more than 13%. By the way, you may not even know this, Dan. It's the best performing stock in the best performing sector of the market this year. IT, so great call. So what do you think of that stock now?
Listen, it went up 10, 12% in a straight line, you know, on no new news. It was a couple upgrades. So, you know, my target was about a 10% move on the breakout. I think you take the trade and you kind of move on here.
Great call again.
Thanks.
Okay, Dan, since Salesforce was just such a success, why don't you head over to the plasma and give us your newest fast pitch? No pressure.
Here's one that I'm kind of socializing a little bit here, and it's called Pinterest. This company went public last year in April at $19. It traded as high as $35 over the summer. And in early November, when the company reported their Q4, they had a very disappointing quarter. The stock was down 17% the next day. They showed decelerating revenue growth. Average revenue per user was disappointing. But they did have some positives there. Margins were better. Net adds were kind of accelerating a little bit, but the stock was put in the penalty box. It closed the year basically flat from its IPO price, much better than some of its other tech IPOs that we saw last year. But I'll just mention one really important point that I think differentiates it from on an adjusted basis. This company is expected to be profitable this year, not expected to be profitable for a few years on a GAAP basis, but they're growing sales at 35%. So they guided down. If you see a reacceleration when they report next month, you might see this stock kind of move up. One of the things I'll just mention is the stock is trying to bottom. It spent some time over the last 2 months below that IPO price, kind of banging around between 18 and 19 and a half bucks. I think 20 looks like a pretty interesting breakout level. And the last point I'm just going to make right here is that, you know, when we look at the focus on these big ad platforms like Facebook and Google, and you look at the monopolies they have, I think at some point you might see some M&A activity for some of these smaller niche players, which includes Snap. But this is a company, again, it is growing users, they are growing sales at 35%, and they do not have the regulatory scrutiny that some of these other ones will. I could see a Walmart looking to buy a Pinterest at some point. We know that Walmart's e-commerce head, Mark Lohr, the company bought his company, Jet.com. That really accelerated their e-commerce. I think a Pinterest within a massive retailer like Walmart would really accelerate, re-accelerate some of their e-commerce efforts. Let's just go to the chart really quickly here. This is how this stock was trading since its IPO down at $19. It was trading pretty well. It broke on that earnings. Expectations are obviously pretty low here. I think you get this thing above 20, you might see a move back to 25 if next month when they report they're able to beat and guide higher. And I'll just make one last point. You could look at February options, which will catch that earnings event and could define your risk. It costs you about 5% for at-the-money calls in February. I like to play it like that for a move back towards 25.
Well, hey, quick question for you, Dan. You got $11 billion market cap on a Pinterest. So let's put a 40% premium on any deal. So you look at a, you know, 15 roughly billion dollar deal. You think a Walmart would be willing and able to digest that?
I do. I think this would be a company that should be a tab, or it should be a feature of Amazon. Amazon can't go out and buy another ad platform like that. And the other thing is, Amazon's ad growth is growing pretty tremendously. This would be a way for Walmart to really just expand their e-commerce capabilities and put a CEO founder like Ben Silberman in the place to take over for Mark Lohr, who is a serial entrepreneur. I suspect he wants to get moving at some point. So to me, that one makes a lot of sense. I'm not saying you buy it for that. I think you buy it if they beat and guide up the stocks headed back to the mid-20s.
All right, good stuff. Come on back here. Okay, no more questions. Time to vote. Are you buying Dan's pitch on Pinterest, Tim?
Yeah, you know, I am. And at one point I thought he was doing an airline, so I drew Dan in a plane. But it's actually Pins, and I would be a buyer. I think the monetization and the fact that in 3Q these guys got EBITDA positive, and also the international MAUs are significantly ahead of progress. Early days of monetization. But I like the sell-off in the price now.
Okay, Guy Adami?
Yeah, I love Pinterest. We've talked about it for a while. Yes, the stock has been difficult, but 330 million monthly average users, ARPU, that's Tim's word, nice. Not mine, but that hangs in. And you're talking about, if there is an M&A deal, you're talking about probably a $16 to $19 billion deal, which in this environment is not a big deal. And I think Dan makes a lot of sense. So I don't think you necessarily own it for that, but that's sort of your tail, and it's not a risk. It's actually a potential huge bonus to the upside.
Okay, interesting stuff there, and a compelling M&A discussion, guys. Appreciate that. So the traders have spoken. What about you folks at home? Are you Pinterested? Vote in a Twitter poll at CNBC Fast Money. We'll reveal the results later on in the show. All coming up. Big sign of the times for Hollywood. This year's Oscar nominations say about who's really running the streaming game. Stick around. And welcome back to Fast Money. This year's Academy Awards were announced earlier today, the nominees anyway, and it's a major sign of times for Hollywood. Let's get down to Julia Boorstin, who's in L.A. with the details. Julia.
Brian, Netflix shares adding more than 3% today after the streamer drew more Oscar nominations than any other studio. 24 nominations in total to Netflix, up from 15 nominations last year. Netflix's Oscar nods top Disney, which together with its Fox Searchlight has 22 nominations, and Sony has 20. Now, the question is whether Netflix, with two nominations for Best Picture for The Irishman and Marriage Story, can win that top award after its Roma lost the Best Picture award last year. Now, The Irishman, with near-perfect reviews, is considered a lead contender. It's going up against Warner Brothers' Joker, which has the most nominations, with 11 nominations in total. Universal's 1917 and Sony's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood both also have 10 nominations. Now, studios do benefit from the awards attention, especially if their films are still in theaters, such as Universal's 1917. But Netflix will certainly also try to make this awards attention work in its favor. We can expect it to mention these nominations in marketing as it tries to add more subscribers and hold on to its current subscriber base, and also as it tries to lure over more top content creators to work with the Netflix platform. Guys, back over to you.
Okay, Julia Boorstin. Thank you very much, Julia. All right, let's trade Netflix. Any point of view on this stock, Tim Seymour?
I've certainly had one. I've been a trader on this, if that means you're selling it, although historically trade and fade meant actually buy. So I'd fade it. And I do think you have a case here where technically I'll let other people talk about that breakout above 325. My argument has been profitability. There's no question this slate is very impressive. And it's also to be reminded, often their 4Q subs are very heavily back quarter weighted, which means I think this is ultimately going to be somewhat positive for the company. I do think profitability is a major, major issue. We talk all the time. Maybe more important is the report of Disney Plus Q1 in early February than actually the Jan 21 earnings for Netflix, because the competitive landscape is what's driving this move.
Yeah, I would say qualitatively 24 Oscar noms, that's great. They spent $15 billion to do it. That's $3.5 billion more than the cash that they generated. So to me, it's a disaster when you put it together with the fact that they have all of the Marvel, all of the Lucas, all of the Disney, all the Pixar, all the Peacock, Friends. I mean, the list goes on and on and on that is leaving in the next year. And you say to yourself, the only way they're going to be able to keep these subs is if they continue to bring these content. And I don't think being a movie studio is going to do it. I don't think dropping 10 episodes of Stranger Things on a random July day is going to do it. So I think this company is at a massive inflection. And all that being said, when we just saw Tesla go up the way it did, there's no reason why this stock can't break up on in mildly improving, like metrics over the next couple months.
Now Lori Calvacini, you're not talking individual stocks. We know that, but you believe as a group, the FANG stock should be sort of sold, ignored.
Well, we talk to investors a lot these days about if you want to move back into cyclicals that are undervalued, what do you sell to do it? What's your source of funding? And one area that consistently comes up is this media entertainment space within the communication services sector. It's basically just been this place that people have hidden for the past year because of trade war concerns, recession concerns. Investors are ready to let go of that part of the market.
Sell,
right now.
Take some profit, use that money to buy other things that are more valuable.
Right, and it's not a commentary on any individual company. It's just simply that the opportunity is perceived to be greater elsewhere, and the reason for hiding out in these kinds of names just isn't there anymore.
Okay, good stuff, Lori. Thank you very much. Up next, put your seat back and tray table in the upright and locked position because airline earnings, they're about to take off. We're going to tell you one name, though, that option traders are betting on, and it does not have a Boeing 737 MAX issue. We are live from the NASDAQ. Fast Money is back right after this. All right, welcome back. The airline stocks, had a little investing turbulence over the last couple of months with one big exception. That is Delta. Delta Airlines far outperforming its competitors. The company reporting earnings tomorrow. And over in the options market, traders are betting the stock could enjoy a nice bounce. Mike Coe is in San Francisco with the options action.
Yeah, so we saw about four times the average daily call volume trading in Delta today for the best performing stock in this space. Right now, the options market is implying a move of about 3.8% higher or lower by the end of the week. That's pretty much in line with what we've seen over the last eight quarters, which is about 3.3% or so. The most active options were the Jan 60 calls, which also happened to expire this coming Friday. Over 8,400 of those traded for about 80 cents. Buyers of those calls are obviously betting that the stock could rally above that 60 strike price by at least the 80 cents they paid. That would suggest that they're making a bet that the implied move or greater will be to the upside. And if we take a look, we can understand why we see this kind of sentiment, possibly. The stock has obviously performed very well. The street is overwhelmingly positive on the name. So if you're inclined to press your bullish bets here, this might be an inexpensive way to do it.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. And we're going to, of course, have full coverage of Delta's earnings, including an exclusive interview with the company's CEO tomorrow morning on Squawk Box. But right now, let's trade Delta Airlines, no Boeing 737 MAX issues.
Well, it's another one of the reasons, and you know, this isn't just luck, that I think Delta is the best, you know, best run airline out there, and trades should begin to trade at a bigger premium to the group. I do think that the valuation is difficult to really assess in this environment, but I still think that the valuation is trading as if this economy is in recession. This is best of breed. Airlines are such great trading stocks that I don't think you have to do any one thing, but I think you should be trading the range on this to the upside.
Yeah, I think that's a great point by Tim. I mean, if you go back to July 17, Delta has been in this $55 to $60 range-ish for the entire time. Now we're at the upper end. So I guess the good news is you don't have to make a decision because this will report before earnings. In my opinion, this is how you play it. You buy it on a breakout above 60. If they miss, you're looking for a pullback back to 56.5, and that's how you trade the stock post-earnings.
Okay, thank you. For more options action, you can always check out the full show Fridays, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Up next, your final trades. All right, welcome back to Fast Money. Time to reveal if you bought Dan's Fast Pitch on Pinterest and the voters have spoken. Unfortunately, they're not buying, but it's not by much. 53% of the people saying no, which means, Dan, that 40-something percent
said
yes.
Give them the dance version. Give them the dance version of Tony Braxton.
Not all is lost. At least you get to hear some Tony Braxton as we head into the final trade. So they don't hate you.
I think the SEC is going to dominate again tonight in a very important football game. I think Delta will dominate the airline sector, at least on relative value, even if airlines look a little difficult in 2020.
I'll give you 6.5. Clemson covers.
Done.
For coffee.
I got
Lori,
it.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thanks
got
for having me. We're selling the consumer discretionary sector. The consumer's resilient. Everyone knows it. Everyone's been hiding out there. There's more opportunities out there if this recovery thesis takes hold.
Slamming the American consumer, Lori.
Damn. Boom.
Yeah, you know, the Pinterest was a trade idea, just like the Salesforce. I think we're in a squeezy market here. Some of the things, when they have a reason to move, they'll move, and that's what I'm playing for.
Guy?
I thought Dan did an excellent job on the power pitch, Sully. I mean, the fans at home might not have thought so, but here on the desk we did. Number one. Number two, GW Pharma. We've talked about that double bottom for a while. The stock is moving to the upside.
Nice.
GW Pharma, we like it. Yeah. Pinterest, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Delta Airlines, Lori, thank you for being with us as well. Thank you all for watching Mad Money with Jim Cramer. Starts right now.